Welcome to World House Radio. Today we're focusing on the water system of the home. For most of us in North America, accessing water is as easy as turning on the tap. We think little of how the water gets to us and seldom worry about not having the water we need for drinking, cooking, bathing, and our other daily activities. It often feels as if we have an endless supply, but in many parts of the world, the reality is very different. Accessing clean, potable water is a daily concern. Today I welcome two guests to World House Radio who are addressing this issue. Monroe Weber Shirk, who is a senior lecturer in the School of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Cornell University, and Melissa Rolstad, a master's engineering student at Cornell. They are both involved in Agua Clara, a project of the Civil and Environmental Engineering Department at Cornell that strives to improve water quality through innovative research, knowledge transfer, open source engineering, and design of sustainable water treatment systems. Thank you both for being a part of today's discussion about water. Monroe, can you tell me more about Agua Clara and the work that's being done in Honduras?
Goodness, this project started way back in 2004. I was visiting Agua para el Pueblo, is an organization in Honduras that I've had contacts with for many years, and I was visiting them, and the director of Agua para el Pueblo, Jacobo Nunez, asked me, what can we do about the many small communities that have surface water supplies that during the rainy season, the surface waters are very, very dirty. When he asked me that question in 2004, I knew what the answer would be if the context were North America. I knew what we would do here to treat that water, but I didn't know what would make sense to do in Honduras. The truth is I sat on that question for a number of years, and then just a few years ago, we began really working at solving that problem. So what we're doing now in Honduras is we are working with Agua para el Pueblo, and at Cornell, we're working on designing technologies that are simple and robust and that can work for these relatively small communities. And we are working with Agua para el Pueblo to have, they're doing the actual construction supervision and arranging for contractors and having these plants built. And we're working on providing the technology so that they have a system that actually works in the end.
I'm curious, Melissa, what your role is in the project and how you became involved.
Well, Monroe was actually my undergrad independent major advisor, so he told me all about the project, and I was very interested because I've always been interested in sustainable technologies, and I've never worked with water. So I started planning the class with him, and so my role is to help coordinate everyone and give everyone direction and help them figure out their problems when they need help and lead the team.
How many other students are involved in the project?
So this semester, there's 35 of us. So it's a fairly large team compared to most teams at Cornell.
Are they all engineering students?
I think we have one non-engineering student, but other than that, it's all engineers.
Are all those students, do they travel to Honduras, or some of them just working from the campus and some of their research goes into the projects that are actually on the ground?
Well, each semester the students are able to take this as a class. So they get credit, and then 20 of us went to Honduras over January break. It wasn't necessary if you were on the team to go, but it was an opportunity that you could have. But if you didn't actually get to go, all the work that you do here at school for the class is all for Honduras, what we were working on when we went on the trip there.
Excellent. Monroe, can you explain a bit more about the actual water systems that are being used and how they were developed?
Sure. What we did is we looked at what technologies are available for making clean water from very turbid surface waters. And there really are only technologies that are capable of handling a really dirty surface water. The technology that we use here in Canada and the U.S. is, we call it conventional water treatment because it's the most common technology used for surface waters. And conventional water treatment consists of a stage where you add a coagulant to water, and that coagulant helps bring the particles that are in the water together and makes them sticky so that they stick together, form larger aggregates of particles that then can settle out of the water in a sedimentation process. And then we finish up treatment here by running the water that has had most of these particles settle out of it, the settled water, we run through rapid sand filters, and then we add a disinfectant, usually chlorine. And so we looked at that as a technology, and there were some pieces of that that looked really attractive, and then there was one piece of it. The rapid sand filters looked a little bit overwhelming to try to implement in a more simple technology setting. As far as other competing technologies beyond what we use here, there is another system of technologies that uses a whole series of filters, starting with filters that are very large chunks of gravel, and then smaller pieces of gravel, and then another filter with maybe coarse sand, and then finally a fine sand filter. That system of filters is called multi-stage filtration. So that's a competing technology that would also have addressed this high turbidity water problem. And those really are the only two technologies that are out there that have been proven. And when we looked at those two technologies, we basically decided that we'd like to try the system that we use here in North America, the conventional water treatment system, but with some adaptations. The reason that I didn't like the multi-stage filtration version is that it requires a really large infrastructure. The processes are relatively slow, so they treat water slowly, and if they're slow, that means they have to be big in order to treat the amount of water that we're treating for these communities. And so they end up having a high capital cost to build them initially. So we didn't go down the multi-stage filtration route. Instead, we went down conventional water treatment system route. And one of the things that I learned is that here in, for example, at Cornell, we have our own water treatment system. And our conventional water treatment plant here at Cornell, the water coming out of the sedimentation tanks is actually clean enough that it would be possible to chlorinate that water and it would be safe to drink. And so that led us to wonder, why can't we eliminate the whole filtration process from water treatment and instead go flocculation, sedimentation, and then disinfection? So that's a technology that we're exploring in Honduras. We're putting together a water treatment plant that uses flocculation and sedimentation, and we do it using systems that were developed 100 years ago, but then with some modern twists on them. 100 years ago, the flocculation systems that were used here in North America were hydraulic flocculation systems, where they just had the water flowing through a series of a serpentine path through a whole bunch of baffles. And the baffles caused the water to experience mixing, caused turbulence and mixing, and that mixing helped produce collisions between the particles so that they could collide and grow into larger masses of particles, larger aggregates. And the beauty of that hydraulic flocculation system is you don't need any external power. You're using the potential energy that the water has. You capture the water from a stream uphill from the community. You pipe it down to the water treatment plant. You use a small elevation drop of the water through the plant to actually power the plant. And so you don't need any electricity or anything else to actually produce the treatment. Only input that you do need is the coagulant, which we're using aluminum sulfate to do that.
Can you just take us through each part of the process and then how it ends up being accessible in the home?
Sure. What I wish I had is a picture I could draw in front of you. Okay, so first of all, there's a dam or some sort of a capture system high up in the mountains on a stream, and that's the water source. So, of course, during a runoff event, when there's a storm, the water in that stream is very turbid. Then there's a pipe running down from that dam down to maybe a hill near the community. So up above the elevation of the highest house in the community, there would normally be a distribution tank, a tank that stores the water from this mountain stream, and then the water goes from that tank down to a pipe system to the community. Our technology, the water treatment system, fits right before that storage tank. So just upstream from that storage tank, we build a water treatment system. Now, in that water treatment system, there are four processes that are happening. The first process is that we are adding a coagulant, aluminum sulfate, to the water and mixing that with the water, called a rapid mix system. From that first process, the water then flows into a hydraulic flocculator, which is basically a tank. In the case of Ojojona, the most recent plant that we built in Honduras, that tank is 2 meters deep and about 80 centimeters wide and 3 meters long. And inside that tank are a series of corrugated plastic roof panels that are placed vertically in the tank in such a way that the water is forced to flow up and down, up and down, up and down to get around all those baffles. As the water is flowing past those baffles, there's lots of shear, there's lots of turbulence, and there's this gentle mixing that's causing particles to collide and aggregate. From the flocculation tank, the water flows into a channel and then is distributed into the sedimentation tanks. The sedimentation tanks are the same size, 2 meters deep, 3 meters long, 87 meters wide. In Ohohona, there are three of those side by side. And the water is directed into the bottom of the sedimentation tanks. And then from there, it flows upward. And in the top half of the sedimentation tank, there are a series of plates that are angled at 60 degrees from the horizontal. So they're fairly steep. And those plates are about a meter long. And of course, they're as wide as a tank. So they're 80 centimeters wide. And they're spaced 5 centimeters apart. So there's a whole series of these inclined plates. And the water has to flow up in between those plates. What's happening is we're trying to provide an opportunity for particles that we produced in the flocculation process to settle out and to find their way down to the bottom of the sedimentation tank and to be removed from the water. And what happens is in between those inclined plates, if you think about a particle of clay or an aggregate of clay particles, better said, that is suspended in the water and it's slowly settling under the influence of gravity, in order to be removed as it's flowing up between those plates, all it has to do is drop that roughly 5 centimeter distance between the plates. If it drops that far, it will hit the bottom plate. And once it hits that bottom plate, it's removed. All it has to do now is, because that plate is inclined at such a steep angle, particles will actually slide, just like a sliding board, slide down that plate and eventually drop off the bottom of the plate and fall down to the bottom of the tank. We've made it really easy for particles to drop out of suspension. That technology, that plate settler technology, isn't an old technology. That's done in many of the water treatment plants here in North America. And then from there, the water leaves the top of those plates, and most of the particles are now removed, and we have clean water leaving the top of the sedimentation tank. We collect that water, and we add a chlorine solution to it and send it into the distribution tank, and then it's onto the pipe system, down to people's homes, and out of their taps.
You mentioned one of the partners that you work with in Honduras. I'm curious what other partners are involved and how the water systems are maintained over the long term once you leave.
Yeah, excellent question. You know, as far as partners working on this project, Engineers for a Sustainable World, which is an organization that began here at Cornell and is now a national organization in the U.S., Engineers for a Sustainable World played a key role in getting this project off the ground. Another organization that I need to give full credit to is Cornell University as providing a home for us. That's how I get all these wonderful students to work on this project. And they're also been very generous in providing support for keeping this project going and helping it to grow. And there are, of course, donors who are alumni of Cornell who are helping to support the project. And then partners in Honduras that keep this thing going. Our key partner really is Agua Para el Pueblo. They are a non-governmental organization that was created in 1984 in Honduras. And they are the lead organization involved in building water supply systems for rural areas as a non-governmental organization in Honduras. As far as sustainability, we worry a lot about this. The whole challenge of making sure that when we leave these water treatment plants, we keep on doing what they were designed to do. One thing to build something and have it work on day one, even that's not so easy, but that can be done. But having it work 10 years later is a whole much more difficult challenge. When we visit Honduras, one of the things that we do is we go around and we visit water treatment plants. You know, we're engineers, so we enjoy doing that kind of thing. We go and visit the water treatment plants that have been built by, you know, by the government or by binational aid organizations. And one of the things that we see is all the ways that these systems fail. Vicariously, we've gotten lots of experience on what kind of things cause water treatment plants to not work well, at least in the context of Honduras. And one of the things that we see is that when the people that are running the plant don't see it as their plant for their community, they often don't do a good job of maintaining it. So one issue is that the plant has to be felt as being owned by the community that it's serving. And then another piece is that when technology is brought in and it's brought in as a black box, where here's this mysterious thing and we're not going to explain to you how it works, but you know, here are the controls and here's where you add the chemicals, but we're not going to explain to you all the details. That's a recipe for disaster. And there are just lots of examples of technology that was brought into Honduras and was introduced that way. As an engineer and an educator, what I find really frustrating when I visit those plants in Honduras is when I ask them questions about how the facilities work, even the folks who are at the top level of management or the top engineers for the plants aren't able to describe. When that's happening, you know that if something goes wrong and if they need to improvise a solution, they won't know how to do it because they don't know what the technology is doing. So what we're trying to do is, and what we're doing is developing a technology that's simple and clever, that's simple enough that we can build it using locally available materials, and we will build it with the help of the local community. And when it's done, they will understand through training that we are offering, they will understand how all the components of that treatment system work. And that way, when something breaks, they will understand exactly what role that thing is playing, and they will be able to replace it because they can go to the local hardware store and buy the pieces that they need to make another one or to fix the one that they have. And I'm becoming a real believer in that whole concept of ownership, of both understanding the technology and having access to the materials to fix it. The first plant that we helped build, we had a number of difficulties with that first plant. We had engineering issues that we were still working on, and the partner organization that we were working with at the time ended up not being that interested in water treatment, and they ended up kind of abandoning the project eventually. But we built the water treatment plant is built, it's working, and the community owns that water treatment plant. And when we go back and visit that water treatment plant, it's still working. They're buying the chemicals to keep that plant going. And our most recent visit, they had recently painted the plant to make it look nice. So there's a clear pride of ownership of that plant. And they had designed a roof for covering the flocculation tank of the plant. And what I found kind of most telling was that the one moving part of these water treatment plants is a very simple float valve that we use to control the dosing of the aluminum sulfate feed, the coagulant. And the float valve had failed, and they didn't abandon the plant because of that. Instead, the plant operator took the float valve to a local workshop, and they fabricated a replacement part, and they put it back together and fixed it. And that just is such a stark contrast with the kind of mentality that we've run into at many of the other water treatment plants, where they don't feel like they own the plant.
Melissa, I'm curious how you found working in Honduras and seeing an engineering project like this actually implemented.
I think that was probably one of the most incredible experiences or learning experiences I've had at Cornell, because you don't get very much hands-on work, and you certainly don't get a lot of hands-on work in a foreign country where things are very much different and the constraints are completely different. I think that for me and for the rest of the team, it was a really incredible experience being able to see what we were doing implemented and also see the impact it has on people's lives. Because if you work on water treatment in this state, you know, the water gets a little bit cleaner but it's already so clean, you know, people aren't going to get sick. But when you work on water there, it's an incredible improvement. Like, it really changes lives, and like, people won't get sick, you know, people won't be dying because they're getting waterborne diseases. And seeing that kind of impact, and also seeing, I mean, because we take clean water for granted, but seeing all the barriers that are there to clean water, really, it just makes you appreciate your work, everything that you're learning at Cornell, building all your skills, and also all the things that we have here, so much more. But really just an incredible experience, incredible learning experience in terms of learning the other aspects of engineering, like working with people, working hands-on with people, material constraints, getting out there and working in a place where you don't really have the correct tools that you need, you know, and just making it work and using all your engineering knowledge with inadequate tools to make something that'll really last a long time. And realizing that the engineering that we learn and, you know, we think is our world because that's all we do here at Cornell is really such a small piece of the entire puzzle. We had a lot of time to reflect on that, and I think it really, everyone grew a lot from the experience.
I'm curious if your involvement in the project has influenced your course of study and your career goals once you graduate from Cornell.
Yeah, well, actually, I just got a job offer with a place where I'll be working on water projects. So it definitely has influenced my career goals and what I'm interested in working on, because I think water is very, very important anywhere you go. And I didn't have such an appreciation before the project, so definitely has influenced me.
Well, congratulations, job offer. That's great before you're even done and trying to figure out what your next step is. That's nice to have that, so congratulations. I'm curious, Monroe, how are the sites chosen in Honduras that will be receiving a plant and what the criteria is?
You know, we're in the beginning stages of attempting to disseminate this technology, and doing the first steps right is just so important. And as part of that, we have a couple commitments. One is we want to make sure that we understand what our role is and what the role of our partner organization is. Our role is to develop the technology and to transfer that knowledge to our partner organization so that they can implement it. The role of our partner organization is they're the ones that have the experience in the country and that know the layout of the land, know who they can work with, know what kind of things to look for in communities. So one of our working assumptions is that the partner organization ultimately makes a decision about which communities to build these water treatment plants in. We can be involved in discussing that with them, but ultimately they have to be the one that makes that decision. A second thing is just thinking about if you're disseminating a new technology, how do you go about doing it in a way that makes the most sense? And we have to be thinking about how these plants are going to be maintained and how we're going to provide follow-up to make sure that if they do run into difficulties, that there's someone there that can help them out over the coming years. And so for the first plants, what we're trying to do is build them close to the capital city, preferably in clusters, so that it'll be easy to on a routine basis send someone out from Aguapato Pueblo to visit those plants and check on how things are performing and make sure that if there are issues that need to be resolved, that we can provide assistance if needed. So I guess those are the two things. Aguapato Pueblo makes the decision about where they go, and we're trying to do them in clusters close to the capital at this point.
I saw that you're also working, Monroe, on a project called Agua Red, and I was curious how it ties in with Agua Clara.
Agua Red is an earlier project. I'll talk about this one with the goal that somebody out there will hear about this and take it to the next step. There's all this great software that can be used to analyze how an existing water distribution system and water supply system, how the hydraulics of that system works. So there's great software for simulating how those systems work. But we don't have great design tools for designing those systems. And the dilemma is that here in the global north, in the developed world, those systems are designed with a huge amount of excess capacity. And so the hydraulic design is actually pretty easy. In the global south, where capital is much, much tighter, they design them with much lower tolerances. There aren't any good software packages for designing those systems. A number of years ago, prior to working with Agua Clara, we attempted to put together a software package that would make it possible for a person to tour a community with a handheld GPS unit and collect data on locations of all the houses, walk the line where they're going to put in a transmission line from the source high up in the mountains down to a distribution tank. So walk that line and then transfer all that data from the GPS unit to this program and have that software program take that data and design a system. That was the goal. We didn't succeed in pulling it off. My expertise is in environmental engineering and hydraulic engineering. My expertise isn't in computer science, and I found that I just wasn't able to work well enough with the computer science students and get them to a place where they could actually get a software package that was robust and able to be used on the ground. So there's an engineering challenge that I hope someone else picks up who's got the expertise in computer science to pull it off.
One thing that I read about the project, about Agua Clara, is the number of families that are helped and the affordability aspect of it, that it's simple technology and it's affordable. I'm just wondering if you can comment a bit about that.
Sure. One of the things that's happening worldwide right now is that a lot of people are focusing on point-of-use water treatment systems. So point-of-use meaning that it's some device that you will use in your home to take dirty water and turn it into clean water. There's a whole raft of technologies that are out there that are attempting to fill that niche. And it seems that the prevailing assumption is that those will be the solutions that will provide the 1 billion people that don't have access to safe water with safe water. And we're saying, you know what? Those systems, those point-of-use systems are actually really expensive. A lot of them are more expensive than what or they're comparable in cost to what we are paying for water here in North America, and we're getting all of our water cleaned up before it gets to our house, whereas these point-of-use systems would only be capable of perhaps treating the water that's used for drinking and cooking. The cost for the Agua Clara system is on the order of $20 per person that's served for as an upfront cost to build the water treatment plant. And then you could fairly divide that cost out over the life of the plant, 20 years or something. When you do that, the actual cost ends up being quite low. The capital cost per person ends up being much less than a dollar per family per month that they would have to pay to keep that plant going, with the idea that they would have to rebuild it again maybe 20 years later. The operating costs for the plant, when you add everything up, the total cost per month per family is less than $1.50. That includes the chemicals, the labor for the operator, and the original capital cost for building it. So $1.50 per family per month. And that's treating all of the water coming into the house. And there aren't, as far as I can find, there aren't any point-of-use systems that actually are that cheap. And the point-of-use systems are treating water that's just for the cooking and consumption. So maybe 2 liters per person per day, whereas we're treating 150 liters per person per day.
Are there any plans to work in other countries outside of Honduras?
That's our long-term goal. Our goal is to disseminate the technology. The first thing we have to do is to absolutely prove that we're doing it correctly in Honduras and that we can disseminate it in Honduras. And once we have that well underway, which is a few years down the road, we'll be ready to think about moving to other countries.
How can someone learn more about Agua Clara and your work in Honduras and possibly get involved with the project?
One thing would be to check out our website. Our website is, instead of www, it's eswserver.cee.cornell.edu/Agua Clara. So that's one place where people can go to learn more about the project. We are looking for especially Master of Engineering students to come to Cornell to join us in working on the project. One of the things that we love as part of this project is to have students over a wide range of expertise, from freshmen to graduate students. Students who come to Cornell in environmental engineering especially, but also other areas in engineering, can join the project. Starting this fall, we hope to have a graduate student working on the project full-time as well, so there are opportunities there.
Also at the website, if they want to learn about the trip we just took to January, all the students wrote journals that tell all the stories, all the things we did, all the things we researched, all the places we saw, in pretty good detail, plus there's a ton of photos with links from our website, so definitely check those out.
Excellent. So one last question for both of you. Considering that you have a clear understanding of the importance of making clean and reliable water available to families, how has your work with Agua Clara changed your relationship to the water in your home and perhaps changed what home means to you? I'll start with you, Melissa, and your thoughts about that.
You definitely appreciate being able to brush your teeth without having to use bottled water, just taking water from the tap. You appreciate being able to wash the floor with clean water, doing things that, because Monroe was talking about how with point-of-use systems, you're just cleaning water that you would drink. But all the other things you use water for, like cleaning your clothes, my clothes will actually be clean because we clean all of our water here. Having clean drinking water from the tap, water fountains, not have to buy bottled water everywhere that you go, it's really different, and you really appreciate it. And having enough water to take a shower, I think, because when we went there, we stayed at people's houses for a little while, and one of the houses that people stayed at, they had one bucket of water to shower with every morning, and it's so different, and you really just appreciate living here so much more.
Monroe, your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think I've been conscious about water for a long time. I had spent time living in Honduras more than 20 years ago, and so I had really appreciated water for a long time. So in my home, you know, there's a couple things that we've done. We've tried to conserve water wherever we can. When I was in Honduras in the 80s, I remember there was one event where we were in a home and we wanted to take a shower, and we had one bucket of water that my wife and I shared, and we took a shower with that one bucket of water, and we were clean at the end. And it just made me realize, goodness, you don't have to have that spray on full blast the whole time you're taking a shower. So that's one thing that we work at in our house. And I think there's just this real deep appreciation. Just last night, I had filled up a glass of water from the tap to drink it. You know, I remember looking into that glass and thinking, man, you can see the whole way to the bottom and it's clear. What a blessing, right? So I think a real sense of gratitude for what we have here.
Thank you both for your time. I appreciate you being a part of this podcast, and I wish you both success with your continued work, Monroe with Agua Clara and Melissa with finishing up at Cornell and then your new job and wherever it takes you working on water issues. I wish you both much success, and again, thank you for your time.
Great. Thank you so much.
Sounds great. Thanks.
For more information on the Agua Clara project, check out the links on our website, www.worldhouse.ca. The two songs used in today's program are both named Water. These songs were created by independent artists willing to share their music online for free. The artists can be found on GarageBand.com, a website promoting new and emerging independent musicians. Links to the artists can also be found on our website. World House Radio is a project of the Institute Without Boundaries. To learn more about the program and the work we are doing on the World House project, please visit www.worldhouse.ca or www.instituteWithoutBoundaries.com. Join us next week for another episode of World House Radio, Stories of Home.